I'm going to read just a little bit more to complete this, the thought intended with these quotes. Here is a quote from another quote from Keith Lowe's Savage Continent. Quote, the Greek Civil War was to have profound effects for the rest of Europe. It was the first and bloodiest clash in what was soon to become a new Cold War between East and West, left and right, communism and capitalism. In some respects, what happened in Greece defined the Cold War. It not only drew the southern boundary of the Iron Curtain, but provided a stark warning to communists in Italy and France, and indeed all over Western Europe, about what might happen if they were tempted to try and seize control. But perhaps most importantly, it drew the Americans back into Europe. When the British announced that they could not afford to continue financing the Greek government's war against the communists, the Americans were obliged to step in. They would remain in Greece and at strategic points across the continent for the rest of the century. It was America's sudden involvement in Greece that gave rise to the Truman Doctrine. The U.S. policy of containing what the American diplomat George F. Kennan called the communist flood that was threatening to wash over all Europe. On 12 March 1947, President Truman gave a speech to Congress declaring that it should now be United States policy to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures, and that they should begin by granting a massive aid package to Greece and Turkey. This was effectively drawing a line in the sand. Eastern Europe might be beyond rescuing from communism, but the Eastern Mediterranean would not be allowed to follow suit, and we'll be in future shows looking at that fact as very suggestive of what we mentioned earlier, the plans of these power guys to rewrite history. We're going to end with this quote from Emmanuel Wallerstein's Structural Crisis, or Why Capitalists May No Longer Find Capitalism Rewarding, in the book Does Capitalism Have a Future? Quote, the one sphere in which the United States did not have an excessive advantage in the aftermath of World War II was the military sphere. And yeah, I mean, you see what I mean? It's like when you have in the back of your mind constantly the truth that they have in their possession, this weapon invented by Nikola Tesla, it changes how you hear everything. Truly, that's why these discussions are so explosive for power right now. It is a Pandora's box. It does change everything about what we think we know. Anyway, continuing. The one sphere in which the United States did not have an excessive advantage in the aftermath of World War II was the military sphere. The Soviet Union possessed a very strong military force, and its troops were occupying a large segment of territory in East Central Europe and Northeast Asia, Manchuria and Inner Mongolia in China, the northern half of Korea, and southern Sakhalin and the Kuril Islands in Japan. It's true that as of 1945, the United States had nuclear weapons and a few other things we weren't told about, but even this advantage would evaporate by 1949. As a result, if the United States were going to play the role of hegemonic power, it would have to come to some kind of terms with the Soviet Union and neutralize its military strength. This was particularly true since internal political pressure in the United States led to a relatively rapid demobilization of its land forces worldwide. It is my contention, says Emanuel Wallerstein, that what ensued was a tacit deal between the United States and the Soviet Union, to which we have given the metaphorical name of Yalta. It seems to me that this deal had three components. The first was a de facto division of the globe into two spheres of influence, more or less along the line of the location of the armed forces of each of the two countries at the end of the war. What the United States and the Soviet Union, in effect, agreed to observe was the primary, virtually exclusive, right of each to decide matters within its sphere. A crucial element of this de facto agreement was there would be no attempt to change these boundaries by military or even political means. After 1949, this accord was reinforced by the concept of mutually assured destruction based on the fact that both sides had sufficient nuclear strength to respond to any attack and destroy the other. The second part, and we now know there was a fourth part, probably goes by the name of the space station. Anyway, the second part of the tacit agreement was the de facto economic disjuncture of the two zones. The United States would offer no assistance on the reconstruction of the Soviet bloc. The third part of the deal was to deny there was any deal. Each side proclaimed loudly in its particular language that it was in a total ideological struggle with the other. We came to call this the Cold War. Note, however, that it was and remained to the end a Cold War. The purpose of the very loud rhetoric was not in reality to transform the other. Each sought rather to oblige its satellites, euphemistically called allies, to toe a very strict political line as dictated by the two superpowers. Neither side would ever support in any meaningful sense rebellious forces within the other camp, and they had the weapons to back that up, did they not? Not only would they not support rebellious forces in either camp, they, I am sure, agreed to deal with internally rebellious forces secretly, using their secret means to do so. Since this might, and they agreed not to support, rebellious forces, and I guess this is the official rationale of the Soviet Union in the Ukraine. They officially say the U.S. supported rebellious forces, blah, blah, blah. Within the other camp, since this might lead to the undoing of the primary agreement of a military status quo between two superpowers. Once the military status quo was achieved, the United States could proceed to realize its overall political and cultural dominance in the world system, with its automatic majorities in the United States and multiple other transnational institutions. The sole exception was in the one agency that controlled military matters, the UN Security Council, where the veto power of each side ensured the military status quo. This arrangement worked very well in the beginning, and then the self-liquidating character of a geopolitical quasi-monopoly began to take its toll. That's called we the people, growing up, growing, learning, wanting our freedom. Continuing, the two most significant geopolitical changes in the two decades following 1945 were revolts in the Third World and the economic recovery of Western Europe and Japan. Unquote from Emanuel Wallerstein, Structural Crisis, or Why Capitalists May No Longer Find Capitalism Rewarding, from Does Capitalism Have a Future? And of course, we would phrase that differently, since capitalism in this space is pure ideology. We must ask ourselves, what are the implications of power hoarding Nicholas gifts to us in circumstances of resource depletion? Are they waiting until they've rendered the entire world population obedient or reduced to a certain feasible number from their perspective? to release them, or do they intend to suppress public knowledge of them ad infinitum? The deeper we go, the more abominable it gets. It's time to call the question of our right to pursue happiness and to convene our global pause, our day of reflection, to plan and mourn the loss of such an unimaginably vast number, and such an incalculable mass of lies must now be set to rights. All the wars of the 20th century and beyond, both world wars, all the wars of liberation, the colonial slaughters, were designed to do just what they did: maximize the body count. All the dead must be laid at the door of the global statesman's sick ambitions. Thank you for letting me go over, if you're there. Still never sure. I really am grateful to those of you who are. I love you. Stay strong. Until next week, peace.
When the little blue bell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work sings a song to the moon above, it is nature that's all simply telling us to fall in. Richard.